From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. A week ago yesterday afternoon at MIT's DuPont Gym in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the 11th annual Boston Open Badminton Tournament's first dozen or so matches were noisily getting underway. The gallery was pretty much limited to the competitors' families and players waiting to take their turns on the court. In the first row of the bleacher sat 15-year-old Jen Perry, who started playing badminton when she was 10. She has not yet specialized as an athlete, but she's got some compelling reasons to keep whacking the shuttlecock.
I also play field hockey and lacrosse, and you just don't get to meet as many people in other sports as you do when you play badminton. We've been to Canada a few times. We've gone to Peru twice. We go to California a lot on the weekends to play tournaments there, Louisiana, Washington. We pretty much go everywhere that there's tournaments.
When she isn't globetrotting, Jen Perry plays her badminton in Marblehead, Massachusetts, at a club called Gut and Feathers. Gut being the strings of the badminton racket, feathers, in this case goose feathers, being a critical component of the birdie one bashes with the gut. In Marblehead, Melinda Caste coaches Perry, among many other players, young and old. A former international competitor who has represented her native Hungary and the U.S. at the elite level, Caste can tell pretty quickly whether a child hacking around on a badminton court has any aptitude for the game.
Usually when we give a kid a racket to their hands, you could see right away if they have any idea how to hold it, or they hold it with two hands, or they think it's very heavy. We like very athletic kids, but you also have to have a good eye on the court to be able to make quick decisions.
Beyond all that, Coach Caste says it's no good trying to succeed at badminton if you approach the game the way John McEnroe approaches tennis.
It's a very calm sport. Like, you really have to...
A calm sport.
Well, you cannot show emotions, really, and then you have to be... I always tell the kids, you try to be good actors or actresses, because even if you're upset, you can show it to your opponent. If you getting upset, you usually lose the next point. You know, it's a very fast game, it's a very... short game.
The brand of badminton being played last weekend at the Boston Open was certainly fast, and in the first rounds, lots of the games were short. The most proficient players mixed leaping smashes with feathery drop shots that fell over the net like, well, dead birdies. The less proficient players were often left gasping for breath with their hands on their knees. By Sunday, when the finals of each of the tournament's five divisions were being contested, only very good players remained. One of the more exciting and noisier matches saw Angeline DePaul and Mona Santoso playing Zhu Hun Li and Yun Peng for the women's doubles title. Angeline DePaul, a native of Indonesia, plays badminton as loudly as Monica Seles used to play tennis. Her taller partner, Mona Santoso, seems to cover the court effortlessly. After they captured the women's doubles title, DePaul explained her vocal style.
Just the excitement and maybe communication also. Because if I didn't do like this, maybe I'm going to be nervous.
Angeline DePaul, now a top international player, has been playing badminton since she was 11, which she maintains initially put her at a disadvantage.
Late start for if you're going to be a professional player, that must be late. Yeah. If you're going to be play for fun, it's okay.
DePaul is a professional. She and her partner each pocketed $900 for winning Sunday's final. The Boston Open distributed a total of $17,000 in prize money, which makes it one of the sport's more lucrative tournaments. Of course, in badminton, lucrative is a relative term.
2 or 3 weeks ago, I played international tournaments in Peru and Miami, and I won those, and there wasn't any prize money at all.
That's Michael Barras, the Canadian champion, who came into the Boston Open ranked third in the singles draw and first in mixed doubles. In the latter event, he and his partner, Valerie Loker, were upset in the quarterfinals. It was a surprising result for Barras, who's made his badminton reputation as a doubles and mixed doubles player, and the loss ratcheted up the pressure for the men's singles final, in which Barras met Raju Rai. Michael Barras prevailed in a close match, after which I asked him if he'd been aware of the way the excitement of the crowd, which numbered perhaps 400, had swelled the longer the points had gone on.
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's always fun to play those rallies to see who's going to crack first and go for something that they shouldn't. And when they do go for it, is it going to pay off or are they going to make a risky mistake? And so when those rallies start to get long, you start to feel it, and you have to remember that he's feeling it just as much.
For his win, Mike Barras earned $1,400, enough certainly to cover the weekend's meals and get him back home to Ottawa in style. Raju Rai, the runner-up, was philosophical about the result. He's still recovering from a knee injury. For that and various other reasons, he couldn't feel too bad about finishing second to Barras.
Oh yeah, definitely. Mike's a good guy, and we've been friends for years now, so it's a friendly match even though the trophy's on the line, but we're just out there to have a good time and give the crowd the best game that we can.
Relatively unusual match in the sense that not only were trophies on the line, there was money on the line. What's the difference between first and second place in this tournament?
Just a little $700, but it's a lot, you know. I wish I could have came out on top today, but, you know, Mike really played well, and I guess I got to hassle him for dinner tonight or something.
The next top-flight badminton tournament, the Pan American Championships, will begin Monday in Calgary. Later this summer, the U.S. Open in Orange, California, will feature a fortune in prize money by badminton standards, $50,000. Anaheim is presently playing Detroit in the NHL's Western Conference Finals. The mere presence of the expansion Ducks in a late postseason series against an original six squad may torque off hockey traditionalists, but as Jane Lindholm reports, the otherwise migratory waterfowl have settled nicely on their frozen pond in Anaheim, and they plan to stay there.
The Mighty Ducks first entered the national consciousness as the children's hockey team coached by Emilio Estevez in the eponymous Walt Disney movie of 1992. When it came to marketing the Mighty Ducks franchise, the House of Mouse saw more than home videos and sequels. It went so far as to create its own real-life National Hockey League team, named, you guessed it, the Mighty Ducks. Disneyland's in Anaheim, California, about 30 miles south of downtown Los Angeles. The Mighty Ducks were born there in 1993, and there they've stayed. But Disney apparently got sick of non-fictionalized sports. The company had already sold its controlling interest in the Angels, Anaheim's American League baseball team, and in 2005 it sold the Mighty Ducks to local investors and philanthropists Henry and Susan Samueli. The ownership shuffle doesn't seem to have fazed the team much. The Ducks are currently facing off against the Detroit Red Wings in the semifinals of the Stanley Cup playoffs. But the changes may have helped the city of Anaheim. Mayor Kurt Pringle thinks so.
Disney's a smart company, and Disney knows how to draw and promote people to its product. But part of the ownership of professional sports teams is there has to be an emotional connection to that team. So in this case, I certainly see the value of having an individual owner who has a certain level of passion personally in the sport.
That kind of personal connection is something both the city and the team are banking on. The Ducks have been selling out their playoff games and have consistently drawn near-capacity crowds to their regular season games as well. Anaheim's attendance rate is a healthy 95%. The Honda Center, where the Ducks play, is owned by the city, but run by the Samueli's management company. Hockey writer Lyle Spector Richardson says when you compare Ducks' attendance with that of other NHL teams, the Ducks are coming out on top.
Anaheim is actually outdrawing traditional hockey cities like Boston and Chicago. But they're also outdrawing the New Jersey Devils, perennially one of the better teams in the National Hockey League. So they're even actually outdrawing the team that actually defeated them in the 2003 Stanley Cup Finals.
Of course, winning helps attract fans and celebrities. This year's playoff success has drawn characters usually seen in nearby Los Angeles. Snoop Dogg attended a recent playoff game. Waving an orange foam finger, he chatted with the FSN sportscasters in between periods.
He's here to see his first hockey game.
Yabba dabba dizzle, push shizzle dizzle.
See, that's what I'm talking about. All right, what are you doing here? You were telling me it's your very first hockey game.
Yeah, my youngest son, he said, Daddy, take me to a hockey game. I like watching hockey, so I brought him to a game. It's right down the street from my house. We love Anaheim. We love the Mighty Ducks. I'm just here to support him. Go, Mighty Ducks. Go, go, go.
Writer Lyle Richardson says high-profile fans like Snoop are going to draw even more people to the team.
He obviously enjoyed what he saw, and that definitely came across in the interview that he gave, and that wound up flying all over the internet. And if they can get celebrities who can come out and support the team, or at least verbally or whatever, come out and support the team, that's only going to help them even more.
A strong association with Anaheim is also helping the team, which officially changed its name this season from the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim to the Anaheim Ducks. That's in stark contrast to the other big athletic draw in town, the Angels baseball team. That team used to be called the Anaheim Angels. Now they go by the long-winded moniker, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Mayor Kurt Pringle says that hurts.
We continue to be very disappointed that the Angels decide to promote a neighboring county and a neighboring city, as we continue to feel in violation of the city's lease because they play in a city building. But we won't talk about that. What we'll talk about, though, is the Ducks felt it would be best to put Anaheim up front. And I think it really does show the difference in the ownership and having a local team that really sees the value of promoting the local community, and the building stays pretty full because of it.
And local sports bars, which fill up with Ducks fans on game days, have benefited as well. At the ESPN Zone right next to Disneyland, Frank Coral and his teenage son Nick stood in front of the bar's giant screen TV in full Ducks regalia as Anaheim played Vancouver in the second round.
It's our own team. We can associate with it. It's our team. We're not Los Angeles, and we don't like to be associated with Los Angeles. I don't appreciate what the Angels have done. In fact, I've lost respect for the Angels' ownership since they've changed names.
And Anaheim Mayor Kurt Pringle is hoping that the Ducks' success, combined with the city's high-income residents and big tourist attractions like Disneyland, will be enough to draw more sports fans to the area.
Basketball would be a great complement to what's happening in Anaheim.
Stay tuned for a fight over that team's name. Anyone up for the Anaheim Seven Dwarves of Anaheim? For Only a Game, I'm Jane Lindholm in Anaheim, California.
Simon Gibbons, who listens to Only a Game via onlyagame.org, emailed this week with a reminder of my gaffe of several weeks ago. He wrote that he could understand my trepidation in saying anything about the Cricket World Cup, since I'd declared Australia the winner 2 weeks before the event ended, but he felt we should acknowledge that Australia actually did win the tournament, quote, in contrast to your usual track record in picking winners. And speaking of winners, Justin Norfleet, who hears the program on WRVO in upstate New York, listened carefully enough last week to hear our Kentucky Derby analyst, Louisville Courier-Journal columnist Jenny Reese, pick Street Sense. I started to feel bad for her as I realized how far back in the pack Street Sense was, Mr. Norfleet wrote. But then something amazing happened. Street Sense made the move, and I got excited over a sport I don't even follow. You and your guests really know your stuff. Thanks for helping make my day. You rock. Take that, Mr. Gibbons. After hearing the story about the decreasing number of black baseball players at traditionally black colleges, Paul Fazio of Keene, New Hampshire, wrote, "When will there be a story about the lack of white basketball players and the disparity in scholarships offered to black athletes? Your stories have no credibility, nor are you doing society any good when all you harp on is one strand of a story." And finally, from Avon, Minnesota, a listener calling him or herself Diener emailed as follows. So, this morning, Bill Littlefield comes on at 6 sharp, and as soon as the show starts, a squirrel crawls down the trunk of the tree in my yard and perches on a branch just outside my window. He sits there the whole show, snoozing, looking around, occasionally flicking his tail. When the credits roll, he snaps to and scampers up the tree. I wonder if he is there every Saturday. And so, apparently, we have some credibility among squirrels, or with one squirrel, maybe. You can send your comments to us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. If you want to know which NASCAR driver has the best setup or who is the top-ranked fencer, male or female, you need to go no further than Charlie Pierce, but he knows so much more about sports than that, and we're about to learn. Hi, Charlie.
And if you won't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. Remember that.
Thank you, Mr. Barnum. In the NBA playoffs, the Cavs-Nets series stands at 2-0 Cleveland, and the Detroit Pistons hold a 3-0 lead over Chicago. Wasn't the Eastern Conference supposed to be wide open?
It is wide open if you're Detroit and probably Cleveland. I mean, the wide open portion of the Eastern Conference was who was going to be playing Detroit for the Eastern Conference Championship. And we'd like to thank the Chicago Bulls for playing. They have lovely parting gifts that they won against Miami, but they have no chance against the Pistons at all. I don't know about you, but me and David Stern would both like to see LeBron James in the final, so I would watch the prospective Cleveland-Detroit series with some care.
The NHL's conference finals began on Thursday, Charlie, when the Ottawa Senators beat the Buffalo Sabres. This matchup presents sort of a conundrum for those inclined to root for underdogs. Do you root for the one remaining Canadian team or the team that was almost eliminated from the league because it ran out of money a few years ago?
Well, this is proof positive, once again, that when teams tell you they're out of money, it doesn't matter. They can still win. The Buffalo Sabres are one step away from playing for the Stanley Cup. I root for the Senators because Ottawa was a city that even Canadians didn't want a hockey team in for a long time, and it is, after all, the national capital. And plus they have that very cool logo that looks like the hood ornament on a 1940s limousine. So I'm going to root for them.
On Thursday, the National Hockey League Players Association fired executive director Ted Saskin, who had been accused of reading players' email. Would Saskin have kept his job if he had bargained for a better collective bargaining agreement 2 years ago?
I think he had a little bit of problem with that. I don't think there was a lot of slack left for him. And this reading the email thing is just flatly bizarre. If you know they're gunning for you, don't set up a stand outside your house and sell them bullets.
I hope Roger Clemens didn't decide to come back to the Yankees so he could enjoy a beer in the clubhouse with his teammates, Charlie, because if he did, I guess he's bound to be disappointed.
Yeah, this is baseball's attempt to divorce itself once again from the fact that beer has been an integral part of baseball for as long as there's been baseball. I won't be impressed by this policy, of course, until the St. Louis Cardinals move out of the stadium they're in and start playing at Abstemiousness Park.
Ricky Henderson, who is a special instructor with the Mets this year, may have begun a comeback drive just this week, even though he's 48 years old. What encouraged Henderson to think he could still play in the bigs?
He caught a foul ball in the stands, which is something I've never done. I've come within about four or five rows, and a youngster next to him wanted the ball, and Ricky wouldn't give it to him because Ricky caught a foul ball in the stands. So he signed the ball the kid already had, and the kid probably didn't have any idea who Ricky Henderson was. I would keep it, too, if I were him. I mean, catching a foul ball is one of my lifelong dreams, and I simply have never even come close.
In a mea culpa of sorts, Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling characterized his own behavior as reckless this week. WRECKLESS on his blog. Did that mean he hadn't had an automobile accident?
I was going to say, it probably meant that he's not beached himself on a reef anytime soon. No, he ran his mouth on the radio about Barry Bonds and steroids and pointed out Bonds' sorry marital history and sorry history with the Internal Revenue Service. And once again, Curt Schilling behaved like the kind of guy you run across the bar to avoid when the conversation turns to anything serious. This is also the guy, you may recall, who had a chance under oath to talk about steroids after having talked about steroids for years and turtled up pretty badly in front of the United States Congress. So apparently, Terry Francona, who doesn't need this with his team seven games ahead of first place and cruising right along, has called everybody together and said, how about we shut up about this for a while?
It's the old Archie Bunker treatment.
Shut up, you!
It's been a strange and unhappy year for the men who broadcast Baltimore Orioles games, Charlie, and not just because the Orioles are not playing especially well. I guess Gary Thorne and Rick Dempsey have to hope bad things don't come in threes.
And, I reiterate, shut up, you! Gary Thorne, of course, was the one who blurted out on the air that he thought Curt Schilling's sock had been painted during the famous Bloody Sock game, and we had a two-week kerfuffle about that. And now Rick Dempsey had the wife of Oriole left fielder Jay Gibbons on, and she was promoting a fundraiser to help fight domestic violence. And Rick Dempsey said he tried to put the left fielder's slump together with the fundraiser and said, Laura, will this kind of help Jay in the domestic violence area? If he doesn't start getting a few more hits, you might grab him around the neck and rough him up a little bit. Shut up, you!
It was learned this week that just Tennessee Titans defensive back Adam Pac-Man Jones met on April 3rd with NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to appeal his suspension for the entire 2007 season due to misbehavior at a strip club.
No.
The night before the meeting, Jones went to, are you ready? A strip club.
This is what happens when the Guggenheim closes early. Guys don't have any place else to go.
The library
Pac-Man! Come on! Go to the Blue Note! Go have a hot dog at a Sabrette stand on 51st Street when you've been called in to discuss the NFL's displeasure with your activities in strip clubs. Don't go to a strip club. It's National Stupid Week.
There is talk in NFL circles about adding a 17th regular season game to the schedule. And so I guess we learn once again that when it comes to the NFL, more is more.
Much more is more. We're going to move this game like out of the United States of America, too. They're talking about adding a 17th regular season game and playing it outside the United States, which is going to make the various paranoids and mountebanks who coach NFL teams really thrilled, let me tell you. Imagine Bill Belichick determining that he has to play Indianapolis, then he has to get on an airplane and go to Oslo to play the Tennessee Titans the next week.
Floyd Landis claimed this week that a U.S. anti-doping agency lawyer asked him to provide any information that might implicate Lance Armstrong. Why is USADA focusing on a retired bicycle
rider?
Because
this is the way drug warriors do business. USADA is possessed by this kind of messianic fascism about its function and the importance of the great national crisis it's dealing with. And it's knuckling Floyd Landis to give them Lance Armstrong so they can hang Lance Armstrong's head on the walls of their agency so none of them lose their phony baloney jobs. This is the way a war on drugs always works.
And finally, Charlie,
Oh, I love this. Go ahead.
And finally, Charlie, in celebration of the achievement of George Mallory, who may or may not have reached the top of Mount Everest in 1924, a number of climbers bound for that summit will wear 1920s-era clothing on the ascent. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, George Mallory died on Everest, Bill, and they didn't find his body until 1998. For some reason, I think that this probably proves that climbing Mount Everest in hobnail boots, knickerbockers, Burberry suits, and even fur-lined motorcycle helmets is probably not the state of the art.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Stupid week!
Thanks for listening to Only a Game. Please check your local listings for the NPR station nearest you to carry our show, and please visit our website, onlyagame.org.